Ms. Peterson.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'd like to say 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
My name is Dennis McLaughlin. I'm with the Western Washington Law Group, and I represent the client in this matter, Frederick Peterson, in his appeal against his lawyers, Davis Wright Germain. Three questions that I'm asking this court to focus on. The first question is, does a client breach a contract with his or her attorney by not paying invoices that exceed a reasonable fee? I submit to you the answer should be no. Second question is, should lawyers be awarded attorney's fees for their efforts in attempting to collect what the trial court finds to be an unreasonable fee? And the answer to that is no. The third is, in meeting its burden of proof, does a lawyer have to produce some evidence that the hours of work it is charging its client is reasonable when compared to the number of hours other attorneys outside the lawyer's firm would charge in the area where the practice is located? I would submit to you the answer is yes. I would like to say what this case is not about so we don't get sidetracked. It's not about what the trial judge determined the reasonable fee was. We've accepted that for the purpose of this appeal. Where the problem is not who is the party to the contract or whether a contract was formed. It's not about the hourly rates of the attorneys, and it's not about whether the court should have exercised its discretion to forfeit more fees than what it found to be reasonable. This is about the central finding in round numbers, so we don't get sidetracked in dollars and cents. There was $120,000 in fees. The client voluntarily paid $40,000 during the term of the representation. The law firm sued for the remaining $80,000 balance. The client defended on the basis of the fees that the law firm was attempting to collect were unreasonable, and the trial court, for all practical purposes, cut it in half, saying $40,000 is reasonable, the other $40,000 is not reasonable. Turning to the breach of contract question, is there a breach? The standard of review is a mixed question of law and fact. The legal analysis, which is what we're focusing on, is the nature and extent of the obligations that are imposed. We are suggesting that this court should imply an obligation in contracts between lawyers and clients that the lawyers' billing reflect a reasonable rate, and that if they do not comply with that implied covenant, then that excuses the client's non-payment of that invoice, because as a material covenant to payment is that the fee be reasonable. That's both as to hourly rate and number of hours charged. Here, the trial court found that the associate that worked on the case, who billed 90% of the fees in the case, overcharged on average 33 1/3%. She worked too many hours, and it wasn't discounted by the partners. Now, seemingly, the law firm in this case agrees with us. If you look at their brief on page 32, the first sentence of the last paragraph, it reads, here, the written terms of services provided that the client would be charged for the legal services provided by the law firm consistent with the RPC 1.5 factors. That's what they say. They say that's what their contract provides. It's consistent with the RPC 1.5 factors. Therefore, they're reasonable. The trial court said that wasn't true. The trial court specifically said they were only reasonable in part. Therefore, they were unreasonable in part. The client does not have to pay those invoices within 30 days like the contract provides if the charge isn't reasonable in the first place. So therefore, there was no breach. Either it's an express term, which I couldn't find in the contract, or it's got to be implied. Either that's what has to happen, because a client can't be said to breach a contract by not paying the entire invoice if it's not reasonable. And if you don't find that, the third alternative is that the contract in this case was void as against public policy. The reason it was is because this contract provided that the time that the law firm actually expends, as opposed to the reasonable amount of time, is given more weight than the other eight RPC factors.
Okay, so this is your RPC 1.5 argument.
Yes.
As I read the record, you raised that argument at the presentation hearing on the findings of fact and conclusions of law.
Well, it was raised also in our answer.
Right, but there's no argument, evidence, or discussion about RPC 1.5 during the trial.
We said that the RPC, that this contract...
During the trial, where do you argue about RPC 1.5? In the trial.
I don't have a record cite for you, Your Honor. I'm sorry. But number two, I would like to say that the judge specifically found in paragraph 7 of her findings of fact that this contract allowed the attorneys to place undue weigh that factor more than the other eight factors. So it was considered by the court, it was ruled on by the court, and the court made an explicit finding in paragraph 7 of the findings of fact and conclusion.
Is that because you raised it before the court entered final findings of fact and conclusions of law?
The record site I can provide you is that we definitely raised it in our affirmative defenses.
I know that, and you definitely raised it at the time of the hearing on the presentation of the findings.
Right. So after all the evidence was in and the court said, this is where I'm going, we said, Your Honor, we have this issue. You have to consider it. And then the court issued the findings and conclusions after that. Real quickly, I would like to at least address the fee-shifting provision. In this case, a prevailing party, we suggest to you there was no substantially prevailing party. The lawyers prevailed.
The court found that Davis Wright was the prevailing party, so you're saying the court erred?
Well, I'm saying that if you look at the mixed question of law and fact.
Well, didn't the court do that?
No, Your Honor, I don't believe they did.
So you're arguing the court erred in finding Davis Wright was the prevailing party?
May I go?
Yes, answer the question.
Thank you very much. Yes, I do, because it's a mixed question of law and fact. You have to take the facts that the court found, and you have to apply them to the law with the de novo standard. The facts are the law firm was claiming $80,000 plus in fees. The client was saying that that was unreasonable, and the court said, you're right, client. You prevail on that affirmative defense, and therefore I'm only going to award $40,000. I'll save the rest for the...
Very well. You have 3 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. Anthony Wisen for Davis Wright Tremaine. This case involves a garden variety dispute over legal fees. After a multi-day trial, including testimony from 6 witnesses, Judge Shapiro entered detailed findings of fact and conclusions of law and rendered judgment in favor of DWT.
We know that. So Okay. Why don't we answer the questions that have been raised? The argument of going backwards seems to be that you didn't carry your burden of proving that the fees were reasonable. What evidence is there in the record that you carried that burden?
I think this essentially is Mr. Peterson's argument that DWT was required to present an expert witness at trial.
Expert or not, you had witnesses. Did they testify as to the reasonableness of the fees and the services provided?
They testified. What was presented, Your Honor, was DWT's entire set of invoices for the entire period, and there was substantial testimony about every detail of those invoices. And from that, the court, as Western Province, was able to determine reasonableness. And I think that's how this ties into the expert witness issue, Your Honors, which was the argument that was presented in Mr. Peterson's original brief. That in certain cases, it certainly is appropriate for expert testimony to exist on reasonableness of a fee, but it's not necessary. And I think not only is that the law, as the Washington practice and the cases cited in our brief show, but it's also common sense, in a sense. I mean, we already had a trial that ended up costing more in legal fees than the underlying fee dispute. And I think requiring expert testimony, number one, would deprive the court of an action that's well within her province, and also needlessly, increase the cost of trials of this sort. So, A, there was lots of testimony about the ins, outs of all these invoices, and B, the trial court.
Well, it's not just the invoices. I mean, that's a shorthand. It's the work that was performed, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
The services provided.
That's right, Your Honor. And the court's findings of fact and conclusions of law as well very specifically go through the trial court's assessment of those very issues. As you're well aware from the findings of fact and conclusions of law, the court conceitedly was troubled by the work that had been done by Ms. Summers, who was a very junior associate, and she found that, it pointing to certain, very specific examples, I think she pointed to, I think there was an answer, affirmative defenses and counterclaims that to which 60 hours were billed, and there are other specific examples where the court did specifically conclude those portion of the charges were unreasonable.
All right. So the other argument is, well, because Mr. Peterson had already paid $40,000 and you only recovered $45,000, the court erred in finding you were a prevailing party. What's the response to that?
Well, before I turn to the prevailing party question, I think there's a temporal problem with the entire unreasonableness argument. And you've seen a lot.
And what is it?
Well, the court is the person who determines reasonableness in this case. And what Mr. Peterson is trying to infer is that Davis Wright did something improper in the first instance when it submitted these invoices. And, in fact, the trial court rejected that very argument. In fact, she used the term dangerous.
Was this an oral ruling?
Yes, I believe, Your Honor, this is in the post-trial. If you look at the transcript, 638, she stated that she thought it would be dangerous to send the message that spending too much time on a task is unethical. And she made other...
Well, now you're segueing into the 1.5 argument, and that's a separate issue.
Let me pivot back to the temporal argument. I mean, I think it's a pretty sort of basic matter of logic. Mr. Peterson is trying to say, hey, Davis Wright Tremaine, you acted improperly by presenting these invoices that had fees that were too high. But that's the purpose of the lodestar test. I mean, that's what this entire dispute was about, was whether the fees were reasonable or not. Ultimately...
Well, the court found they were reasonable in part. So
yes,
can we now move on to the prevailing party issue? Because time is short.
Sure, Your Honor. So as the prevailing party, two points on that. Although it often appears harsh and draconian, the rule in Washington is that you are the prevailing party if you prevail on a claim.
He's arguing you didn't because you only got $40,000.
I don't believe that's the right legal assessment, Your Honor. I think what you look at is whether Davis Wright Tremaine prevailed on its claim for breach of contract, and it did. I mean, there are specific findings and conclusions in the order where Judge Shapira indicates that Mr. Peterson breached the contract by failing to pay the invoices to DWT. Now, even that being so, this is not a particularly close case, and I think even if this was a substantially prevailing party standard, which it isn't, Davis Wright was awarded $83,000 approximately out of the $123,000 approximately that it was seeking here. So
you don't take into account the $40,000 that was already paid, or $43,000.
Well, I do think that's important, Your Honor, because I think had had the trial court after the trial determined that Davis Wright was entitled to $30,000 in fees, then as I read Judge Shapira's findings of fact and conclusions of law, I believe her conclusion would have been that Mr. Peterson did not breach the contract and that Davis Wright is not entitled to anything from him. And furthermore, let me make another point on that real quickly, which I think is important, is if you look at Mr. Peterson's affirmative defenses, he actually seeks two things. He seeks the very same contractual fees that he's arguing that Davis Wright isn't entitled to here, and he also seeks disgorgement. So if you look at his affirmative defenses, and I think that's, if I can find that, Your Honor,
We can find the answer.
Okay. Anyway, there are affirmative defenses there where Mr. Peterson in the first instance was asking, and it may have been an alternative ground. He raised several affirmative defenses, but he said, hey, this is a breach of contract. I win. I should get fees. So it's not appropriate or equitable to say now, since he's lost, that shouldn't be part of the contract.
All right.
And furthermore, well,
go ahead, and then I have a question.
Yeah, sure. The fact that he seeks disgorgement, I think, highlights the point of the prevailing party. So if and perhaps this is more properly styled as a counterclaim, but he raises an affirmative defense. If there was again, if Davis Wright had only recovered $30,000 and he was subject to disgorgement, then I think it would have been plausible that the trial court here could have ruled that Davis Wright was on the hook for fees and that that Mr. Peterson prevailed. But
all right,
that's not what happened.
So one of the affirmative defenses is the assertion that the agreement with Davis Wright violated RPC 1.5. There was no evidence at trial, no argument at trial, but there was an argument made at the presentation of the findings of fact and conclusions of law. Am I correct that there was no argument, no evidence related to RPC 1.5 at trial?
Not that I've been able to locate, Your Honor. Again, I wasn't the trial lawyer, but in my review of the record, it appears to begin with the affirmative defense, and then it becomes an issue again after trial.
That's when he raises it.
That's correct. That's right. Correct.
And your argument,
answer your full question?
Yes, but your argument in the brief is, therefore, that issue is waived.
Yes, among other reasons, that it's not a sound argument.
Well, your first argument is it's waived. I know you're making a number of alternative arguments, yeah, but you are saying that argument is waived.
That's right. I believe that if Mr. Peterson intended to ask the trial court, what we're really be talking about here would be reformation of the contract or rescission or some contractual remedy of that nature, perhaps relying on the RPC underlay here. I believe that Mr. Peterson was obligated to present that issue at trial so that Davis Wright would have the opportunity to address it. Perhaps it would have been a summary judgment motion, something of that sort.
So very quickly, the only other issue then has to do with this implied reasonableness argument that's being made.
I'm not sure if I...
Well, he identified three issues, and one of them is that we should imply a reasonable fee.
Answer the question.
Your Honor, and this is frankly... I think the briefing has been a bit of a moving target. I think that the long and the short is that at the end of the day, Judge Shapira determined that what part of the amounts that had been invoiced were reasonable and which part were not. And it's, in a sense, it's kind of that simple. And the terms of service, the final point I'll make, because I know my time is up, Judge Shapira made a specific finding that the terms of the contract, including the terms of service, were fair. And so I think that wipes up any of these good faith reformation type arguments that are being raised, whether RPC or some contract remedy. That's also settled because Judge Shapira, who heard all the evidence, concluded the contract terms were fair, and we're simply asking the court to affirm.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors. First, on the question about producing evidence, I think you can take it from counsel's evidence that they produced no expert or the testimony of their own attorneys that the number of hours worked by Carly Summers, the associate attorneys, were reasonable.
Why can't the trial judge make that determination on his or her own?
Well, first of all, I want to make sure you understand this is a contest between an attorney and a client.
I understand those contests. I was in private practice. I bill clients.
Right.
Why can't the trial judge make that determination?
Because the obligation is that they bear the burden of proof. They bear the burden of producing evidence. That's the first thing. And the burden of persuasion. They produced no evidence.
Would it have been sufficient if each attorney in testifying said, and I felt that my hours and my hourly rate were reasonable?
Well, it depends on whether they were saying reasonable in the community in general. If somebody would have looked at this and said, well, you know, I reviewed each invoice and I checked to see, make sure each hours were reasonable for the task performed in light of my experience as an attorney, perhaps that would have worked. But that's not the case here. That's the problem. None of the attorneys that they called on to testify said that. They just said this is the actual number of hours spent without any evidence as to reasonableness, and they bear the burden of proof. They should lose on that issue. The halftime motion for involuntary dismissal should have been granted. The second case on the fee-shifting analysis, the fee-shifting agreement, it's predicated on the breach. And the first thing about the breach, there was no breach because the invoices in whole were not reasonable. There is no duty of a client to pay an unreasonable fee or an excessive fee to an attorney. And Mr. Peterson had the right to say, wait a second, I don't think that's reasonable. I'm not going to pay that invoice. And until that reasonable determination is made, there can be no breach. And if there is no breach, they do not prevail, because counsel said that the springboard for prevailing party is the breach. And you can't punish a client for successfully challenging a law firm's bills, saying what you're claiming and what you're attempting to collect are too great, and the $80,000 you want is too great, I think it's zero, you think it's 80, the judge said 40, and then require him to pay $90,000 to the law firm for their own work they did in attempting to collect an unreasonable fee. That is a violation of RPC 1.5, collecting an unreasonable fee, combined with RPC 8.4, making any attempt to violate the rules a separate independent violation. What they did by trying to collect an unreasonable fee is violative of the rules. They should not receive attorney's fees for doing that action. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The next matter is marriage.